Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program. I'm your host, David Katzmeyer. I come to you as I do every Thursday night at 8 p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Have a wonderful show tonight with Mr. Grant Noble, a very astute, well-read individual who is learning about the history of our world. In the process of that, he has come across research of many cycles in the astronomy around us, in long-term weather cycles, and in the histories of the United States, other countries, and of world civilizations. And in the process of that, he's been able to make heads or tails out of the research that he has found, put some things together on his own. In fact, he's used his studies of cycles that he found throughout history and all of his research to play the market successfully. He was a futures broker from 1977 to 1983. Since then, he has traded his own account and those of friends. In the futurist market, he has written articles for virtually every futures-oriented magazine. This includes Futures, Technical Analysis of Stocks and Commodities, Cycles Magazine, and more. He now writes a market newsletter, which he trades to others like Mark Farber, who write their own letter or do analysis that helps his trading. Samples of his market newsletter can be obtained by emailing him. He will communicate with you, folks. You can reach Mr. Noble at gnoble, N-O-B-L-E, gnoble at sbcglobal.net. That's Samuel Barry Charlie Global.net, gnoble at sbcglobal.net. So tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about his application of cyclical analysis in the market. We're going to talk a little bit about the natural history of our world and how that is revealing signs of cycles in everything around us, a little bit about the celestial motions of the sun, the stars, and just basically everything moves in cycles. And so it will tonight as our special guest Grant Noble joins us. Grant, are you there? Oh. Let me click your phone thing. Okay, Grant, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Oh, Grant, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Looking forward to getting into some of these things. I've had a few discussions with you before the program, and it's just been fascinating. So, Grant, tell me, what motivated you to go and into the market with the and start to apply some of the cycles analysis that you've learned?
Well, when I originally started out in 1976. In the I said 77 to 83. I actually started studying for my test in 76 and early 77, and I realized that, you know, there's a especially when I started. I started in the cattle livestock business. There's a moon cycle, and we started to realize that the moon has great influence over grain trading. So I mean, and there's a seasonal cycle and, you know, of a year, you know, in various commodities. And so, you know, we know about cycles. It's nothing new. The problem for most cycle researchers is that they're so, you know, long-term and kind of vague that, you know, they're not needed, you know, with leverage instruments. I mean, you know, and when the markets get wild, you can literally double your money in a few minutes, you know, and or lose it. So, you know, totally. So, you know, there's been a tendency not to take cycles too rigidly, but people did know about them. What I understood about cycles started to revolutionize in about 2000, 2002, when I started to realize that the planets have direct influence on human behavior. And this is not just your horoscope that you see in the newspaper. It's a it's the actual scientific reasons why things happen, that people feel better on and buy stuff at certain times and they sell things because they feel bad. And so this can be predicted in long time in advance. And, you know, I have the books on my shelf that talk about astonishing predictions that have come true just this year. I was looking at a book that I have called The Roadmap of Time. And in that book, which was written in 1974, it predicted, you can actually see it on the charts, that would be a dry, hot period in 2012, and they're predicting a dry, hot period for 2013. This was based on the research of Raymond Wheeler, a professor, I believe, out of Kansas in the 1940s, who went through virtually everything that was known about human history and determined various events and used that to make an idea that there are cycles, in, major cycles in weather, particularly 500, 170 years and 100 years. And these cycles can be predicted in advance. And I believe, I think I know a lot of the planetary reasons why these cycles are so regular. And so, you know, I've been studying this and trying to hone it and try to make it more of a market-friendly system that, you know, you could actually use on a day-to-day basis. And so, well, I talk about a lot of different things in my market letter. I do really respect the cycles world, and I do talk about cycles, but I usually mention them in passing, as you probably know after reading all my stuff for a couple of weeks here, that I talk about it in passing with the fundamentals. So we're ready when fundamentals will probably peak, which is, I think, is happening now. I think this could have been predicted a long time ago that you'd have a fundamental peak right about now, where everybody would feel good and want to buy stocks and crude oil and even gold. And, you know, I think that will reverse shortly. So if it has, if it could even top tomorrow. So indeed. Anyway, that's where I came from. Is, you know, it's been a long process, at least the last 10 years of really, really getting buckling down to cycles and trying to apply them on a day-to-day trading basis.
So this is not something you studied on a weekend seminar.
No, in fact, I wrote a book called The Trader's Edge, which I forgot to put in my biography, and it's a good book. It was written in 1994, and I talked about how people just, you know, want, you know, to learn everything in a few minutes, and they want a simple system. And I took my book, I said, well, there's a simple system. You just use moving averages, and if you have a big enough of account, and over time, you will make more money than you would in the stock market. And I can say that without any doubts, but there are years where you're not going to make any money using moving averages, and the other years you'll make 50-60% because things are trending so dramatically, like 1973 or 1974 or 2008, where you had this huge rally up and then a huge rally down, and anybody who had enough money to diversify over a broad range of futures could make a lot of money. And then there are years where things chop up and down and you feel like you're buying tops and selling bottoms. So, but, you know, I believe that that's, you know, kind of the standard of the industry is that, if you know, is using a trend following system. And I talked about it in my book right up front. I said, you know, that's your standard. And, you know, you could learn that in a few minutes. And if you have enough money and enough patience, you should do well, relatively well. In that, but nobody has the patience, so they want to make $1 million overnight, and they want to be able to brag at the cocktail party, or you know.
Quick fix. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the long-term weather cycles as observed by Raymond Wheeler, who points out there's a 500 or so year cycle in weather changes, and I believe that correlates with a 500 year shift between east and west. And as the power is shifting to the east now, what we find out about Oriental thinking is that they are very long-term planners, whereas here in the United States, we like to think short-term results, the bottom line for this quarter.
Well, that could be, I don't pretend to know the Oriental mind that well. I think humans basically underneath are, you know, I mean, if you say that they're long-term planners and, you know, all I know is that every time I hear tremendous stories of Chinese gambling, I mean, they make, you know, they're very much into gambling. So, you know, there may be this outward appearance of long-term strategy, but, you know, we could see this every night as we see the opening of China and there's a big pouring in of money that comes up pouring in, and we actually can take advantage of it, particularly in the grain market and the metals market. We often see peaks lows during, you know, right at 9 o'clock Eastern time at PM in the market. So I see this all the time. So, I think that they like to think in terms of thousands of years. I mean, I think that's part of, you know, if you're China, you're Chinese, you're kind of humiliated. You know, I mean, here you thought you were the center of the universe, and all of a sudden these barbarians with large whiskers and white skin come rolling around and kind of made you, you know, second rate. And so I think that that's part of their psychology. But, you know, I'm not so sure that long-term planning is so much their idea. I just think that they're going to become more dominant because I think our industrial production is changing from what I would call mechanical type of production to intellectual production. And, you know, the Chinese and the Indians are very bright people. They're as bright as anybody, and there's more of them. And, you know, they tell me there are like 10 million, 20 million, 10, 20 million of people are studying piano in China. You know, I mean, there's more people studying piano in China than Europe and the United States put together. And, you know, that's a huge, you know, input. People are studying engineering and other things. And if the demographics don't completely collapse in India and China, that's another matter. I believe that they will continue to, gain on us and start to equal us down the road, because I think that intellectually they're as good as we are, you know. So.
Well, the cycles of time show that there's power shifts going on all the time. I hear it said that every nation of Europe was once a world leader. And Dylan said, the first one now will later be last, the slow one now will later be fast. The times, they are changing. And it's interesting, you point out, we're going from a less mechanical model of leadership into a more intellectual. It's a virtual world. The world is flat. And as we become more intellectual, then, you know, it's rock, papers, scissors, you know. So we are seeing some power shifts. Grant, in trading, do you like a combination of technical analysis and fundamentals for your final decisions?
Well, the problem with technical analysis was when I first started in the business, I mean, charts were kind of exotic. I mean, literally. I mean, there was – I started even before – when I could never forget that in 1977 or 78, the first computerized chart service came through, and it was just in the Mercantile Building. And people had to be plugged into the special computer in the basement to get these wonderful charts. Before this time, you had to do everything by hand, or you got a chart service that sent it to you once a week. Computers were barely, out of the Stone Age. And at that time, technical analysis, I believe, had extreme validity because very few people were doing it. And what you were seeing was the trends of the market and the psychology of the market was there. Well, today, everybody and his brother has technical analysis. And today is a typical example. Today, you know, every technician and his brother is bullish because we have a breakout. And, you know, okay, but I've seen this in the first people to really get very technically oriented were the commodity traders. And I saw it all during the 1980s after, we got very much more technical and more people got computers and more people saw had the charts. You were constantly seeing false breakouts on the top and false breakouts on the bottom. And I think that that's happening a little bit here in technical analysis. I've seen this more and more. I mean, I'm seeing things in the Wall Street Journal and other major things to talk about, they'll talk about esoteric type of RSI or, stochastics or even moving the 50-day moving average or, the chart pattern or this or that or Elliott Wave. And this is all very, very new for the stock market. And it's very, very old for the commodities market. And one of the reasons why I've gone to more of an astronomical cycles approach is because I believe time is a bigger factor than price now. That a lot of prices are distorted by a very heavy currency and inflation manipulations. And so I understand technical analysis. I mean, I can talk about people's technical analysis, and there's certainly some validity to it, and people do use it. But I think, for making longer-term positions, I think that, you need to look at something else, and that's why I've come to timing. More than anything else. And you can use technical analysis I mean, there's a nice technical analysis service that, you know, puts out everyday kind of support resistance, and they do a good job on it. And I actually get it for free. It's the, you know, they have it on their website, and, you know, it's there. So, I mean, this is the golden age of, you know, a technical analysis. Okay, that may be good for the day, but it doesn't tell you whether to go long or short, and, you know, what level, and it also doesn't tell you, you know, the longer term, whether you should load up or whether you should be trading lightly. And I think that this is all why I've become more of a time and particularly emotional, what I call sentiment trader. And the sentiment goes up and down based on, you know, the way people feel. And people feel better when it's with certain planetary positions and certain weather conders than they do in others. And, you know, this is, if you can know these in advance, this is a huge advantage to your trading.
Indeed. I'm sure there's a maturity in having experience. One can follow many indicators, but then once you get the signals, you have to know what to do with those signals once you get them. It's not just throwing on a light switch and turning it off. Grant, back in talking about technical indicators starting to get passed around within these last decades, we've got to get used to using these new tools. Looking back on 1987, the stock market in October crashed more than 500 points. What seemed to be a bit of a bizarre aberration that it would happen. So many people were unloading at the same time. And yet, as far as that aberration went down, it didn't seem to be an overall meter of what was happening in the economy. In fact, the Dow Jones closed up a few points by the end of that year. Back then, Grant, were a lot of people getting hold of the same technical analysis programs and following the same indicators, some big players, and they were all making the same reaction because of
technology?
Well,
you know, the problem, here's the technical analysis, and this is the nightmare of what so-called sophisticated traders is the aberration, the so-called black swan, the extreme move that almost nobody can anticipate but does happen. And the technical indicators will say this is severely overbought or severely oversold, and you can draw chart lines all you want. When people get into a panic mood, you know, they overwhelm the system. And the question is, can we predict these panic ups and panic downs? And my answer is yes. I think we can predict a lot more than people think.
Oh.
And to me, it's in this business, it's not so much you know, how should I put it? You know, being right. It's being right with at the right time. In other words, there's a lot of people. The classics, you know, there used to be a guy named Joel Greenberg. He was the king of the hogs. Literally, when people, he got on the elevator, people would call up and said, he's getting on the elevator, so he's going to walk into the pit, the hog pit. And this guy made a decision that 11% T-bill rates was very too high. And you know what? Over time, he was right. But you know, he went broke, lost everything, you know, the $50 or $100 million he'd made trading hogs and other things, because the T-bill rate went from 11% to 21%, and eventually now, what is it now, zero? So, I mean, you know, he was right, but right at the wrong time.
Oh, my.
And so, you know, that's, you know, things go in extremes, and you have to, you know, timing to me is far more important. It's if you know the day things are going to happen or likely to happen, then you can anticipate, you know, the extreme happening. And I think that that's why timing is so more important. The only other strategy is just a blind trend following. And 90% of people who are trading, you know, bigger money, that's what they do. They just trend follow. And, you know, the trend changes, they go with it. And they diversify over a large portfolio. If they can make more than the S&P in a year, you know, make 15, 20%, 30%, they think it's a great year, and, you know, that's fine. And, you know, that's certainly the strategy of virtually all the major commodity funds and most of the other hedge funds. They're all trend traders. Without almost very few of them are not trend traders. The biggest ones have to, because of their size, they have to be more into time. Because they may have to spend a month or literally a month getting out of a position and turning it over, going from long to short or short to long.
Yeah.
And it could take many months. And so they need to have, you know, they need a timing factor. But, you know, for your mid-size hedge fund and your commodity trading advisors, they don't, they're almost all trend followers.
So it's a combination of technical fundamental. It's a combination of following the trends as versus cycles analysis of where you can see where the influences are going to be in advance because of periodicities, maybe more than one periodicity that you're following. But a trend follower can only read the indicators to know what is happening now. And then they have to interpret, you know, well, if it's going in this direction, it might take so long for it to turn around. Or if the signals all go neutral or the majority of them go neutral, then I'm going to see uncertainty in the market and go with that case. But if somebody studies cycles analysis, can plot energies far in advance. Is that true, Grant?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I believe that you have a, you know, the factors are such that you can have a greater idea of what, you know, when a trend might end. And that's the great question of all the trend followers. But even the cycle problem is that cycles are not regular and they are periodic, but they're not perfect and they're not regular. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is because the planets are elliptical and there are many different factors operating on creating these cycles in the natural world. And that's why we see, and we can talk about a six-year cycle in stock trading, which Dewey talks about. And it's a very powerful cycle. And it's one of the reasons why I think we're topping now, you know, and then we could talk about an 8-year cycle or a 9-year cycle. And these cycles are valid. They often work, but they often don't work or precise enough that you can make major trading decisions. I mean, today we had a huge market move. You know, if you had levered up, you could have made a ton of money. If you'd gone to short, you'd have lost a lot of money. And so, you know, cycles may tell you, you know, within a couple of days of where you might look for a top or a bottom, but a couple of days can be an eternity. Is there anybody who's been ever through the 2008 collapse or the 1987 debacle or the, you know, the melt ups that we've had in gold and silver in 1980? You know, a few days can be a gigantic difference in, you know, profitability of your firm, of your fund. And so, you know, that's where I think the astronomical things can tweak the cycles. This is what I do every month. I look at, you know, you had Norm Winsky on. I mean, he sends me a whole sheet of the entire month where every major, you know, planetary ingress, you know, angle is put on. Now, he doesn't do certain things that I do, but, you know, does a pretty comprehensive job of it. And I look at this, and then I look through, you know, what possible days are cycle tops. Now, part of the problem with cycles is that, you know, there are only a few people that really have a large degree of information, background information, let's say back to 1880 or whatever, in commodity trading or bond trading. Most of our cycle work has been based on the stock market. And the stock market is different than commodities and or bonds. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of people say, well, aha, you know, commodity trading. Well, when did crude oil start? 1983. You know, that's when the futures market started. So they have all the data back to 1983. But what about the data before that? And, you know, if you're trying to deal with cycles, you want to have is at least 10 or 12 different hits before you even think, well, this might be a cycle, not just a random chance.
Yes.
And so that's our problem is data. I'm always searching for more data so that I can get an idea that, you know, what effect, you know, the markets, you know, we know the planetary positions, you know, way back when. And they may have influenced the stock market one way, but they influenced the commodities market another way. And today, commodities are far less important to the world economy than they were 60, 70, 100 years ago.
Indeed.
Way more agriculturally and industrial-based. And today, it's a little less important. They're important, but they're not as important to the, you know, the average person isn't a coal miner or a farmer anymore. And
yeah.
So, you know, there's a little bit of the difference.
A little bit more moving into a virtual world now. You know, you mentioned Norm Winsky. He was on this program 2 weeks ago on August 23rd, 2012. And he, like you, found that there were correlations in the natural world by looking at the barycentric changes in the sun as influenced by cyclical changes of the planets around us. And he didn't go off on tangents like you. He researches many, many different things and finds that there are physically based phenomena in the solar system that corroborate what he's doing. By the way, that program 2 weeks ago is a runaway. It's three times as more listens to that program than the next most popular show that we have done. You can listen to that, folks, by coming here to blogtalkradio.com/cycles. You can find the archive to tonight's show. And Norm Winsky from August 23rd and Ray Tomes last week on August 30. All the archives are here. So if you don't have to remember everything that you're hearing here tonight, you can come back and take notes and listen to the archives. So Grant, in the process of combining the abstract reality with the world of physical causality, in addition to your cyclical analysis following the fundamentals, you're anchoring this in astronomical data too. So are you finding correlations in nature and the solar system to support some of the moves that you make in the market?
Well, I believe that, you know, it's a kind of a three-way dance on influencing people on Earth. One of them is the actual planets themselves. They're finding there's actual kind of like ion trails between the planets, and they do have energy going back and forth, and that's traditional, what I would call a Ptolemaic astrology, and you know, traditional finance, the Bradley model. They you know, it's all planetary positions in relationship mainly to the Earth. I mean, you know, how it looks from the Earth, and then there's a little bit of more of an addition, and most people who are in the business say that the bigger thing is the planetary positions in relationship to the sun. In other words, heliocentric planetary positions. But I would add two other factors which very few people talk about. Some people do in the financial astrological community, but not many. And one of them is the what I call the barycenter, which is the center of gravity of the solar system, which is not the center of the sun. It can range from very close to the center of the sun to about two radiuses outside the sun. And the gravity shifting back and forth across the rim of the sun and into the interior and out the interior will affect the power of the sun. So the sun will, you know, have more power at certain times. And this does about three things. Number one, it does warm the Earth. And warm is good. I'm sorry, global warming people. Warm is good. It helps the crops. It helps people feel better. It's good. And when times are warm, as in the medieval period when they built the Chartres Cathedral, or about the time of the peak of the Roman Empire, people, you know, have a easier time living. And when it's cold, like in the 15th century, which was a century of hell, or the modern minimum period where there were, you know, people actually starved in Europe. People don't remember that, but it's happened. Or even the Dalton minimum, where you know, you had the summer without, you know, the year without a summer, and New England really literally could not get crops in because it was a snow in July. These were very hard times for the planet, and these are not good. Whereas warm periods, like we've just experienced, are, you know, peaks of civilization. And this is what's frightening, is not only do we have a debt crisis because people have felt good and felt like they could borrow and pay back, but, you know, cycles, their two major cycles are saying that we're going to have some sort of a mini ice age by 2030, and the war cycles, which Dewey extracted from Wheeler's data, and that's Edward Dewey, from Raymond Wheeler's data, the peak about the same time. So, you know, the future is a little bit more grimmer than it was 20, 30 years ago, and particularly when 1990, when you had the fall of the Soviet Union, people were looking upon, well, this means you know, worldwide peace and prosperity and everything will be wonderful. And I think people are starting to realize that, you know, the times have changed from that. And the worldwide debt that was built up during this time because everybody wanted everything and felt they could pay it back is now coming due. At the same time, there's a tremendous stress on the planet. And next 20 years are going to be very unusual times.
And some aspects of that, not the actual events, but the influences, could have been predicted a long time ago by watching astronomical cycles. And the warming and the cooling effect on the Earth may, in fact, be a result of cycles. Now, there can be an influence as well because of man-made deforestation and laying pavement and so forth. But that alone is not the only thing at play. And there are short-term weather cycles for warm and cooling, some 60 years, and there are great long-term cycles as well. So we've got to consider all factors.
Yeah, of course. And the very center, by triggering the warmth of the sun, when the sun is warm, it does two other things that people don't really understand. One of them is that the sun energy expands from the sun, and it creates a solar shield, which protects us from cosmic rays, which are emitted from the center of the galaxy. And the cosmic rays, when they interact with our atmosphere, create clouds, and clouds create cold, and cold's not as good as warm. So when the sun is at its peak, it keeps cosmic rays through its solar magnetic field that expands during this time, its solar shield, so to speak, and that helps also. And finally, this is kind of mysterious, all of a sudden we don't have volcanoes when the sun's at peak power. Volcano erupting around the equator it can make, you know, huge differences in temperature. And when there's massive volcanism around the equator, you get tremendous problems for people. You know, I mean, literally it gets cold and dark. This happened after the Temboric, volcano, I believe it was 1815. By 1818, you were having terrible winters all over the world and terrible crop problems. And we saw a little bit of this when the Icelandic volcano blew up in 2010. All of Europe had problems, and we suddenly had, you know, major drought in Russia, and, you know, for, you know, had airplanes were disrupting, and
yes,
you know, and when we there actually this was a smaller volcano. The major volcano, when it's blown up, it's created, you know, starvation conditions in northern Europe several times, and so but that doesn't affect the climate that much. But that's a microclimate that actually does things. If a major a volcano blows up around the equator, it puts aerosols in the air and it stops the sun. So, you know, it's kind of like a snowball rolling downhill. One way, it's everything gets better and better because the sun's in peak power and we don't have the volcanoes, it gets warmer. We don't have the cosmic rays, it gets warmer. Everybody's sun is good. People, this is known. I mean, the Federal Reserve even has a study that says when it's sunny in New York, the stock market is higher than when it's been rainy and cloudy. It's that simple.
Yeah.
People feel good with the sun. The sun helps give you vitamin D and many other things. And, sun is good. And that's why people go to beaches. That's why people go out and, you know, have fun in the sun. It's part of it. And that's why people feel depressed and they have, you know, in the winter. And this is a major problem in places like Finland and other places where you have, like, Helsinki's like 3 hours of sun in the winter. The deepest part of the winter, so of course they go out in a sauna. They go out in the sun and go stark naked and try to stimulate their body and try to get a little bit of sun. So,
well, we got to consider all factors when we're looking at anything because it's an interconnected universe. It's a holographic universe. There's fractal relationships and everything. Folks, you're listening to the Cycles of Change radio program here at blogtalkradio.com/cycles. You know, I'm fascinated by something you said, Grant, is that radiation from the center of our galaxy can make it cloudier, you know? And then you said that with the barycentric changes, the sun, there's a field emanated by the sun that protects us from the radiation from the center of the galaxy. Made me think of how the Earth's magnetic field gives us a barrier against the radiation from the sun, and yet the sun is creating a field that's giving us protection from the radiation of the center of the galaxy. So weather and natural conditions have profound effects on the economy, and all of these things are influenced by cycles. It's not just the four seasons as the Earth goes around in 1 year, but it's the barycentric changes, it's how much warmth we're getting from the sun, it's combined effects of the planets bringing us warming and cooling cycles, and we have to take all of that into play. I mean, we're not an island, are we?
No, and here's a classic example happened in 2007. There is a, I call it a planet, it's now called a planetoid or a small, you know, dwarf planet or whatever. It's called as Pluto. It is actually a binary planet. It has a fairly big moon called Charon running around it. And it creates a tremendous amount of electric current. It's almost like a dynamo. So even though it's very far away and it has, you know, a very small mass compared to any other, and that's why they downgraded it and said it's no longer a planet, it actually has tremendous influence over our weather and our electromagnetic system. And a classic example was in 2007 when the Pluto was in between exactly between the galactic center and the sun, heliocentric. We had one of the warmest winters we've ever had in December of 2006 and January 2007. It was extremely warm. When it was between us and the Earth and the galactic center, which happened three times during that year, it's typical, you know, triple conjunctions and, you know, retrograde and direct movement in relationship to the Earth, to the galactic center, because of this, the way the Earth orbits the sun. Every time that happened, people, you know, there was no cosmic rays. And guess what? Despite the fact the economy was deteriorating all during 2007, people had euphoria. They felt wonderful. Everything was great. And as soon as Pluto stopped hitting the galactic center and started to move away in December of 2007, it was lights out. And that's part of the reason why you had this huge change from, it's sort of like a roller coaster. Everybody's at the top, and then all of a sudden it's a huge plunge because you go from that to where suddenly everybody feels dark and dreary, and you know the clouds are out, and it's suddenly cold. And the fact is that during this time, because of the barycenter scraping the sun for almost 8 years, from 2000 to 2008, the sun suddenly goes into this period where they have hardly any sunspots. And it was supposedly a shock to the scientists. It was no shock to people like Lanchine and Eddy, who predicted this a long time ago, that you would have colder weather. And all the global warming people were so had egg over their face, because suddenly we have this record cold in Canada and record cold everywhere. We have, you know, a snowstorm in Iraq, and it was terrible during this time. And part of it is, the sun was actually powered down. So you go from this, it was powering down even while Pluto was keeping us from the galactic center. So suddenly when Pluto doesn't do that anymore, you know, you got this huge cosmic ray storm coming to the planet. You got the sun at low ebb. And so people went from euphoria to, oh, my God, things are awful. And, yes, there were political changes. And, yes, there is, you know, but, you know, why did people feel so good during this time that they borrowed money up to their eyeballs?
Yes.
You know, and didn't notice. I mean, there were plenty of people. I even said in September of 2007, I'd be happy to send people what I sent them out to everybody. I said, you know, the stock market's going to go down at least 25% next year. This is a top. Now, whether I didn't have any idea. I said it may even go down 50%. And it went down 55, which was, you know, a little bit beyond what I even thought could possibly. Uh-huh. But, you know, this could have been predicted just based on the on the economy and on the what was going on. And but the astral forces, I mean, people, a lot of good people, like, you know, predicted this was going to go on, but they got out of the stock market in 2006, so they looked like chumps when the market moves up. And I saw this in 1987. There were a lot of people got out in April of 87 saying, this market's frothy, it's overvalued, you got to get out of the market.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the crash came, guess what? The people didn't go with the people who got out of the market. They stayed with the people who they transferred to because, of course, things are cheap now, so I might as well stay put. So you're really punished in, you know, part of the psychology is you're really punished when you tell people the bad news that the prices aren't going up because most people are biased to bullish. So, you know, my wife's been this for real estate. You know, for every one person, she's been preaching for 4 years, real estate's topping out. You better sell immediately. Do not fool around. And you know, so many people just ignore it, and they keep thinking, oh, it's going to get better. It's going to get better, and it doesn't get better. And the same thing happens, and they don't want to hear the bad news. In fact, they'll transfer to another broker who, you know, will give them, you know. I mean, this is happening. This is human nature. I've seen this again and again.
Support what they already believe. You know, one thing I hear is that Wall Street Journal quotes, Barron's Magazine quotes, and a lot of things like that are often read by some as a reverse barometer because the people who publish economic news are in the process of not necessarily predicting. They're in the process of selling their publications. In order to do that, you have to sell what people believe, and people believe whatever they feel at the time.
Yes. In other words, when they feel bad, you tell them bad news because that's what they feel. When they feel good, you tell them good news because that's what they feel. And part of this, of course, is people feeding stories to the media, and the media's people are lazy. And so, when, you know, I saw this personally, and people would say, okay, you know, somebody would say, well, I guess I got too much silver. So they'd call up somebody and tell them, give them all the reasons why silver was wonderful. People say, well, sure, this, and they're all facts. But, they, you know, they're facts that we've known about for a month or 2 months or maybe 2 years. And so they finally get into the major papers. It's a little late in the game. And so I wrote a whole chapter of my book called Media Trading, and I wrote an article about it, which was probably, you know, the most successful article I ever had. I had people calling me from Europe saying, you know, please, do you have a service? And at the time I didn't, and it was before the Internet, so it was a little harder to do it. So I know it works. Today, of course, the media has changed. In the old days, everybody, the Wall Street Journal and Barron's were dominant. Well, today, everybody, they have an international, people can read it on the Internet, and you have Zero Hedge. You've got so many Seeking Alpha.
I mean,
there's so many of them now. And so you've got a little more diverse media, and things change. I still think the Barron's cover of this week with a bull, you know, standing proudly while a cannonball from a bear knocks him over is a big sign that this is a top. You know, and I, you know, that's why I'm fairly confident that probably tomorrow is a significant top. It may not be the top for the whole year because we still have an election to go, but it could be a top for a couple of months.
Well, I think some people are going to be contacting you. We're speaking with Grant Noble about cycles of world history and in nations and how you can have practical application for this knowledge when you learn how to use it. You go from theory to practice when you're in the market because it's not theory when it comes to making a profit or a loss. It's actual results. But folks, you can reach Grant at gnoble, N-O-B-L-E, at sbcglobal.net. So, Grant, as we're looking at some of the long-term changes that have gone on, we know that there's influences on us from the planets, from the sun, even from the galactic center. Natural events such as vulcanization can really profoundly affect the market. What message might you have for us in maybe the next 5 or even 10 years of where we're coming from, where we are, and where we might be going, possibly, with influences?
Well, you know, I think the major influence is global cooling. And, you know, it's very typical of the media to hatch onto something. And in 1974, I have Time Magazine articles talking about global cooling and how the world was going into an ice age because of aerosols in the air keeping out the sun. 30 years later, suddenly it's CO2 that's heating the atmosphere, and that's why we have global warming, and that's why we need to, you know, have command and control economies. I mean, you know, people, a lot of environmentalists are what we call watermelons. They're green on the outside and they're red on the inside. They're very much into control, and they'll just seize whatever event that they coming along, you know. And as I say, I have this book, you know, Roadmap of Time, was written in 74, saying that now it's going to be very cold, but by 2002 it'll be very warm. Now that had nothing, you know, the major rise in aerosols in the air occurred between 1914 and 1974. We're a lot less polluting today than we were then. You know, people didn't care. They just threw, you know, just trying to survive. They didn't care. You know, a lot of coal furnaces even. You had, you know, lots of things that were throwing dust into the air. And at that time, people said, well, the reason, you know, I call it man-centric ideas, that, you know, somehow man is influencing something, that, you know, that was causing the great coolness. And it wasn't. It was just, you know, you could have predicted this based on cycles and based on, you know, planetary influences on the sun's power. And that's what's frightening now to me. It's not overly frightening because I have trust in the Lord, but the fact is that, you know, the next 20 years, according to Landsheed, according to Eddy, according to all the great climate people who, you know, including even Wheeler, is that you're going to be in a cold period by 2030. And it should be, it could be as cold as the Maunder minimum. It could be a Spohr minimum or the Dalton minimum. And this is going to put a huge strain on the systems of the world, and nobody's planning for it.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and that's part of it. And I think that that's the major thing that we face, is that the planet is not going to be as hospitable to us 20 years from now. Now, I believe technologically we have the tools to do this, but whether we sociologically we're ready for it is another matter. Mankind tends to think in terms of what's my next meal and not think in terms of long-term planning. And, I think we're going to have to start facing up to this. But, you know, when we're talking about global warming, when really it's global cooling, I don't know whether we're going to be able to do it fast enough.
Well, and Grant, I want to add something here, if I may. What my observations are as we're becoming less physical and more intellectual is that we are becoming a little bit more long-term thinking, and that's a trend that's going to take place for the rest of this century and all throughout the next century, and be a little bit more long-term, look for things that are greater and outside of ourselves, and start counting more than one thing to reach a conclusion.
Well, I agree with that, but I think what normally my study of history is that before that happens, there's a crisis, okay? And crisis, I think we're having a crisis, a world crisis that will reach a peak in the next 20 years. And then afterwards, I think, and after the crisis, I think mankind will recover and have quite a long period of growth.
Yes.
And so, you know, but I think the next 20 years are fairly grim from a war cycle and a planetary cycle. I don't think it's unsolvable, but I think you're going to see a great deal of chaos and breaking up. And I mean, this is exactly what happened with the start of this cycle 500 years ago. I mean, you know, you wouldn't have given a dime for Western Europe in 1490. I mean, it was a wreck. And, you know, but there were some intrepid sailors out of Portugal and out of Spain. And you had a little bit of, the onslaught of both the Mongols and the Muslims were stopped by a minor miracle. And you had a Reformation which freed up people and a printing press that freed up people to read the Bible and also read all the texts. And no longer was learning was just a little bit of a minority. And I think that made a revolution in the in Western civilization. And I believe, but before that time, you had a horrendous period. I mean, after building the cathedrals in Chartres and having a really kind of a prosperous time where Greenland was green and they grew grapes in Scotland, you had a terrible cold wave that, you know, with the Black Death and everything. And by the you had this huge population decrease in Europe and a tremendous crisis in Europe that happened before this, Great Awakening around the turn of the 15th century. And so, you know, this is normally what happens. You know, you had the Dark Ages, the real Dark Ages, about 900, very cold. Vikings running around looting, everybody's rolling around, Slavs, Bulgars, the Muslims attacking, this happened in China too as well. India, you have this huge crisis in civilization, and then afterwards you have a period. And of course, Wheeler talks about this. So I believe we're at the end of a 500-year cycle, and we'll transition, and the transitioning period is not going to be an easy one, so in my opinion. And I think we're starting to realize that. Everybody knows what needs to be done in Europe, for example. Everybody understands that they have to cut the entitlement programs and they have to free up their economies. I mean, Sweden did this in 1990. They had a crisis, and they're now humming along. But unfortunately, politically, this is very difficult in Europe. And the other problem is the demographic collapse of Europe, and also China and India are going to make a huge, problem. I mean, you're going to have 200 million men in China without women. This is very dangerous. These are kind of going to be pretty desperate. And to me, that's something that's never happened before in history, where you have this huge imbalance because of selective abortion, basically. And this also occurs.
You're allowed to have one child, and it brings honor to the family to have a son.
Yeah, you got to have a male because they're the only one who will keep you alive. Because there's no retirement benefits, or nobody trusts in the government to give anything. So, you got to have a kid to take care of you in the old age.
So you have an overcrowded environment, which is male-dominated. Is that a recipe for expansion by one way or another?
Yeah, it's a recipe for war, is what it is. And I believe that that's the major problem in the world today, is the China problem. And, everybody says, oh, China's going to lead us. China's going to... It's now the biggest economy in the world, and blah, blah, blah. I think China has huge problems. It lacks of resources, and because they've made this decision to kill their children, basically, the demographic problem is going to be so enormous that, it's almost insolvable for them, without a huge revolution in politics in China. I mean, if there was a technological revolution, we could do a lot of things in I talk about this often in the market letter. I mean, we have the technology today to make the world a semi-paradise. We do. We have huge amounts of gas and oil and energy all over the world. We're suddenly, quote, peak oil is now a joke because we have oil all over. We have the technology with thorium plants. You can build a thorium plant on the size of a small house. It doesn't have any pollution problems because... It's not it can't be made into a nuclear bomb. It doesn't have fissionable products that are going to be, dangerous, make a dirty bomb or something. And yet, because we decided in the 1960s when this was invented, we're not going to have these plants because they don't make enough plutonium and uranium for a nuclear war, nuclear bombs. And that's one. We have superconductivity at room temperature. We have nanotechnology. We have possible fusion, cold and hot fusion. These are cutting edge. But when I'm talking about thorium plant and room temperature superconductivity, or at least nano wires of carbon instead of copper, these are there. We've got them. And we certainly have a huge amount of oil and natural gas and coal. And we don't need to kill each other, and we don't need to spend all this money on wars and everything else. I think human problems now is not technological. For the first time in human history, the major problem is spiritual and psychological. We just do not, we are so short-term oriented, we cannot make the changeovers. And, people who are making money using with the shortage of energy or present technologies are fighting like crazy to prevent anything from happening. And this is nothing new.
Well, perhaps if we go from survival of the fittest to survival of the wisest, as Deepak Chopra believes that we may be approaching, he thinks that evolutionarily, in anthropological terms, we crawl along ascending slowly until we take great steps. And we have taken a few great steps over a long period of time. He believes we're about due for one right now. If we are, then maybe we can turn our attention away from conquering each other to conquering our problems together. Usually war happens when someone feels that they're more entitled than someone else, or that they're better than someone else, or they should be more dominant than someone else. When we start working together, instead of having a hierarchy of dominance and have instead a network of cooperation, maybe then the only people we're going to try to be better than is who we are right now as a collective. And I just hope, George Harrison said, with every mistake, we must surely be learning. I only hope that we have the wisdom to reach that point, because there are more people who are beginning to talk like you. And with the rise of the intellectual cycle, as it were, I think that you're going to be heard by more and more, Grant.
Well, let's hope so. I'm not as optimistic that it's going to be as easy as you think, because I think in the human spirit, the first murder was due to envy. Cain slew Abel, and that's very human. The idea is, I need something more. I mean, even the poorest person in America today lives like almost like royalty compared to the average person of 1,000 years ago, and yet
you have this.
People feel like, oh my, I need more, or the rich are impressing me or something like that. And, there are definite problems in the world. There are people near starvation. There are people who are in desperate need. But on the whole, the world is probably less like that than it has been in history. And yet you have this cauldron of problems and hate and various things. So I think the problem is a spiritual problem. It is not a physical problem. And I think that also there is a cycle for spiritual stuff, and we are due for a major, as well as conflict, we should have a major, religious awakening during this time, as people start to realize that the major problems are not financial or even technological, that they are inside humans, and that humans are going to have to, if they want to survive. And this has been shown for a long time that things are having problems like this.
Well, maybe we are moving in that direction, Grant. You pointed out that you have a better understanding on how to play the market instead of just reacting to indicators. When you look at things greater and outside of yourselves, and as we started to discover and plot the planets, we found new ways to understand why there's warming periods, cooling periods, why there are influences on us. And so we as a people might understand that as we try to look at the world around us and not react with fear, but to use a little more reason, that we may not have to offer sacrifices in order to have the sun rise tomorrow. It's going to rise tomorrow just fine on its own. And when we start reaching beyond ourselves and not think that the sun goes around the earth, we're going to realize that there are great forces at play in the universe and beyond that are influencing us. And maybe if we start hitching our wagon to those kind of stars, even further than the ones we see, we might understand how to make sense out of the world of cycles, the world of physical causality, and have a focal point, a compass that will guide us through the cycles of time. In the final 90 seconds here, Grant, what would be your final message to our listeners here on the cycles of change?
Well, I think the final message would be that if you're thinking about everything, there's a time and a season for everything, and timing is far more important than the actual prices or other things that a lot of people worry about. And timing is huge, and I think that's where people should concentrate more about how. When to do things and not what to do. And that's my thinking, particularly in the marketplace, but I also think that's true in life as well.
Well said, Grant. I appreciate you coming here and edifying our listeners here. You've been listening to the Cycles of Change radio program here at blogtalkradio.com/cycles. We can come back and listen to archives to tonight's program and others. You can also see upcoming shows. We'll be posting them to let you know in advance who will be here. So the world is moving in cycles, and there's things greater and outside of ourselves and within us and around us influencing the market and everything else. Thank you, Grant Noble. I hope people contact you at gnoble@sbcglobal.net. Thank you very much for listening. September 6, 2012. I'm David Katzmann, your host. Good night.